Good morning. My name is Eduardo, and I will be your conference facilitator today. At this time, I would like to welcome all of you to the CLASP National Transitional Jobs Network call on transitional jobs programs for hard-to-serve TANF recipients. All of your lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After each speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer period. If you would like to ask a question during this time, please press star, then the number 1 on your keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. It is now my pleasure to turn the floor over to Abby Frank.
Thank you, Eduardo. Good afternoon, and thank you all for participating in what promises to be an interesting discussion here this afternoon. I know many of you by on the line, but for those that I do not, my name is Abby Frank, and I'm with the Center for Law and Social Policy. I also serve as a co-chair of the National Transitional Jobs Network, who is co-sponsoring this call with us today. And I'm going to be serving as a moderator for today's audio conference. As you all know, states are facing difficult choices regarding their Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, programs. The Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 increased effective work participation rate requirements and narrowed the definitions of allowable work activities. TANF administrators, many of you on the line, are facing tough choices. You can focus on designing programs to meet the increased participation rates, regardless of the impact on families, or focus on increasing work participation rates through the creation and expansion of programs that improve long-term employment outcomes, such as transitional jobs programs. The focus of this call is on the creation and or expansion of TJ programs for TANF recipients. TJ programs have been used successfully to provide hard-to-employ TANF recipients with paid work experience. These programs serve as a bridge to unsubsidized employment as they combine time-limited subsidized employment with a comprehensive set of services in order to help participants overcome barriers and build work-related skills. They are consistent with a work-first approach as they aim to help participants begin work as quickly as possible. But a key difference in what makes transitional jobs programs stand out from other work-first approaches is that TJ programs typically offer a more supportive work environment, provide additional training, and enhance connections to other services that help individuals succeed in the labor market. A number of studies have found that participants who graduate from a transitional jobs program find unsubsidized jobs, realize an increase in family income, develop improved skill levels, and have greater self-esteem. With us today is Sharon Parrott, Director of Welfare Reform and Income Support at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She has extensive knowledge of the TANF program and routinely provides technical assistance to states in developing their programs. Sharon will provide an overview of the changes enacted in TANF as a result of the passage of GRA and the interim final regulations and the way in which TJ programs can be counted within the allowable work activities. Also joining us is Diane Klontz from Washington State. Diane serves as a Community Work Programs Manager of the Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development. Washington State has been a leader in the development of transitional jobs programs for TANF recipients, and Diane will provide detailed information about the operation of their statewide TJ program called the Community Jobs Program. We will first hear from Sharon, and after that we will have a brief period of question and answers. Sharon, it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to you now.
Thanks, Abby, and hello to everybody on the phone. I'm going to do a quick overview of the changes to the TANF statute with respect to the work participation requirements as well as the regulations. I'm going to make it quick. I know that some of you on the phone are living and breathing these new requirements every day, and others of you may be less familiar with them. So I'm going to provide a brief overview and then move into what is really the meat of the call, which is how do transitional jobs fit into the new structure. And then I'm happy to take questions on anything during the question and answer period. Maybe I should have said it quite so broadly. Okay, so for the TANF changes, as many of you know, the Deficit Reduction Act, which was actually enacted early last year, changed in many respects the work participation rate structure under TANF. The work participation rate is simply a measure of the number of adult recipients participating in work activities that meets very specific requirements as compared to all the families receiving assistance in a state's caseload. So what are the main features of this new participation rate structure? The first is that states will have to meet a higher effective work participation rate. Without going into all the details of how the statute accomplished this, most states will have to meet higher effective work participation rates, which means that that fraction, if you think back to your fourth grade math, sort of your this fraction that is the work participation rate, where the numerator is the number of people participating and the denominator are most families receiving assistance, that states will have to meet a higher participation rate. And in the next year or so, we'll have to meet a participation rate that is awfully close to 50% when all families are considered. The second sort of structural change is that the work participation rates themselves apply not only to families that receive assistance in a TANF-funded program, but also to families that receive assistance in a state-funded program where those state dollars are counted toward the state's maintenance of effort requirement. States have to spend a certain amount of state money in order to qualify for their federal TANF block grant. Those state dollars are called state maintenance of effort funds. Under the prior law, if families received assistance that was funded with those state maintenance of effort dollars and they were in a program that got no federal TANF funds, the federal requirements didn't apply to them. But under the new structure, even if a family gets assistance and they're in a program that only is funded with state dollars, the federal work participation rates apply and they're considered in that work participation rate calculation. And finally, the third structural change is that HHS was given and then used very broad regulatory authority to write a lot of new rules with respect to how states need to run and manage their work participation rate program, their welfare to work programs. And in particular, those new regulations narrowed what counts towards the participation rate and puts new requirements on states in terms of how they monitor and track and document the number of hours that someone actually participates in work activities. Okay, so what does it all mean? To boil it all down to sort of its simplest kind of so what question, the first thing is that most states are going to need to increase the number of people that are participating in countable work activities. The second is that it's going to be harder than it was in the past for states to simply decide that what a family needs to do to assign a family to an activity that isn't countable under this work participation rate structure. When the work participation rates were easy for states to meet, states could put people in activities that didn't necessarily count under this participation rate structure. But now that the participation rates are hard for states to meet, it becomes more difficult for a state to decide, well, I want you to do this program over here, and even though it doesn't count, I know that that's what's best for you, and it's okay because it's not hard for me to meet my federal requirements. That's a harder thing for states to decide to do. The third is that I think some states will certainly consider, and in fact many states are considering, whether some families for whom these federal work participation requirements are inappropriate, whether they should be served in a program outside the TANF structure, whether they should be in a state-funded program where those state dollars aren't counted towards this state spending requirement, the state maintenance of effort requirement. And finally, states, I think, will consider whether or not they want to, as part of their strategy for meeting work participation rates and improving outcomes for families, I think states will want to consider whether to expand assistance to working families, a strategy that can help improve states' work participation rates. So that's by way of background. So now the question at hand is, how do transitional jobs fit into this new structure? So transitional jobs programs can very clearly help states meet their work participation requirements. They help by having more people participating in work activities that are countable under the participation rate requirements. Transitional jobs at their very core are fundamentally subsidized employment programs. They are also, as all of you know, much more than that. But subsidized employment does form an important core activity in transitional jobs programs, and subsidized employment is an activity that counts towards the work participation requirements and doesn't have a lot of other restrictions and limitations on it. As you won't probably be surprised to hear, though, the devil really is in the details. Because of the way the law is structured and the regulations are structured, states and TJ providers may need to rethink some aspects of their programs to make them fully countable towards the work participation rates, in essence, to make them fit within the new TANF structure. So to understand why there may have to be some tweaks to how some TJ programs are run, it's useful to understand this, to understand when different components of TJ programs can and can't count towards the participation requirements. So what I'm going to do now is sort of go through some of the key components that are typically or often found in transitional jobs programs and explain to you when they can count towards the participation rate and when they can't. And then I'll sum up with what that means in terms of creating effective TJ programs that can fit within the new TANF requirements. So the first thing to know is that any activity, any time spent in an activity that is paid an hourly wage is fully countable towards the participation requirements without other restrictions. So what that means is if somebody is doing something in your program, whether it's a job site work task or whether it is an education and training task or whether it's a job readiness task, if they are doing something for which the TJ program is paying them a wage for the time they spend in that activity can be classified as subsidized employment, and it is fully countable. That hour is fully countable towards the work participation requirements. I should have said that for families to count towards the work participation rate, they have to participate a certain number of hours, and so people have to accumulate enough hours for them to count towards the rate. So any time spent in a paid activity can be counted as subsidized employment and is fully countable. Now, time spent in activities that are not paid on an hourly basis within your programs sometimes are countable and sometimes aren't. So activities that are designed to address barriers to employment, such as substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment or counseling, time spent arranging childcare, if those are activities that people do in a program and they are not paid an hourly wage for the time they spend doing them, those activities can count, but with some very important restrictions and limitations. Unfortunately, no more than 4 consecutive weeks of participation in those kinds of activities can count towards the participation rate, and no more than 6 weeks and in some cases 12 weeks, depending on the circumstances in a state, no more than 6 or 12 weeks in those activities can count over the course of a year. And what makes this particularly frustrating and difficult is that under the HHS regulations, if somebody spends an hour in one of those activities, it counts as an entire week. So what that means is that to the extent that your program or programs you're contemplating in your state have components that are quite important that relate to removing barriers so people can succeed, when those activities are not paid, they have these restrictions apply to them. When they are paid, those restrictions don't apply. The second issue to think about are education and training activities. Now, remember, if education and training, time spent in education and training activities that are paid are fully countable without restrictions. When they aren't paid, there are limitations that apply. If a recipient is participating for 20 hours in paid activities or in other core activities, which we can talk more about, but for the purposes of TJ programs, if somebody is participating 20 hours in paid activities, then education and training can generally count, and it can count without further restrictions. There aren't time limits. There aren't caps. Those hours can count if it's in addition to 20 hours of paid participation. If someone is not already participating 20 hours that are paid, then education and training can still count, but some additional restrictions apply. Vocational educational training, think about it as job training, can count, but people have a 12-month limit over the course of their lifetime in the amount of time that they can be on TANF and count towards the participation rate because they're in that kind of vocational educational training. And the state has an additional restriction that only 30% of their participants in welfare to work activities can be participating in vocational educational training. Some forms of basic education, like GED preparation as well as ESL classes, can count towards vocational training if they're embedded within a job training program. If they're standalone, those can only generally count if someone is also doing 20 hours of other activities. And again, in a TJ program, that would really be 20 hours of paid activities. Okay, so that's a lot of rules, and they're very complicated and extremely detailed. So what does it all mean for setting up or continuing a TJ program? I think the first thing that states and TJ programs need to do is think about how many hours can I afford to have that are paid hours, where I'm paying an hourly wage. And then to think through for each recipient or for groups of recipients in different circumstances, how should I fill up those hours of paid activities? Because if I pay for an activity, if I'm paying it as an hourly wage, I have the most flexibility in what somebody can do. Because as long as I'm paying them, I can count it as subsidized employment. What that may mean is that for some recipients, think about a new participant in a TJ program that has some pretty significant barriers to employment that need to be addressed before they can be successful at 20 hours a week on a job site. Those recipients, you might want to use those paid hours. You might want to use some of those paid hours in activities designed to remove barriers to address a substance abuse problem or a mental health problem, instead of having them on the job site. So I think it's really important to think through, okay, how many hours can I afford to pay for, and how am I going to fill those up? And I think it means that you may have more diversity than you now have in how many hours people are assigned to a job site versus other activities because of the need to really maximize those hours and paid employment in the things that are most important for that recipient to do. Once you've decided what you're going to do with your paid hours, if people are going to participate above that number of hours, those hours you generally have more flexibility. You can have those hours be education and training and have them generally count towards the participation rate. Although, again, those barrier removal activities are activities you're generally going to want to have in your paid hours because otherwise they count against these very severe restrictions and the duration that people can participate in those activities. So you might imagine a particular recipient first starting with more of their paid hours in activities related to barriers and maybe some basic skills. And then as they are more ready, more of their hours could be converted over to job site work time kinds of experiences. And so it might shift over time. A little bit of good news that I should mention before I wrap up is that tracking of subsidized employment, the tracking requirements for paid activities are actually easier to meet under the HHS regulations than tracking other kinds of activities. Under the HHS regulations, if somebody is in paid employment, and it does not matter whether it's subsidized or unsubsidized employment, if they are in paid employment, then every hour does not have to be tracked. Instead, you can look at how much somebody is working, how many hours they're participating in a subsidized employment program, for example, and project forward that number of hours in paid employment over the next 6 months. So that if they then miss an hour because they were sick or whatever, every hour doesn't have to be documented the way it does in, for example, vocational educational training and indeed all unpaid activities. So finally, just to wrap up, I want to say that from a programmatic perspective, if you got to close your eyes and imagine the perfect set of rules, I imagine that many of you on this call would come to the conclusion that this level of micromanaging for programs such as transitional jobs programs that are clearly work-focused but that are comprehensive in nature and have more than one activity, that level of micromanaging is at best silly and at worst counterproductive. It makes your jobs harder and may not result in a better program and could indeed even result in a worse program. But these are the rules that we have. Unless HHS changes some of them, this is the world that all of us are living under. And I think with respect to transitional jobs programs, the important message is that while some of these rules, you know, may mean some rethinking of some elements of how you structure those programs, TJ programs ultimately can play a really important role in helping families and helping states meet their participation rates. It is an activity that's countable. It is an activity that has some very positive results, and it is something that I think can be one of those, we call them win-win solutions, things that can help states and families improve outcomes. And with that, I'll turn it back to Abby.
Great. Thanks, Sharon. And there was we really appreciate your outlining all that. And I just want to note before I open it up for Q&A to everybody that CLASP and the Center on Budget are jointly working on a guide. There was a guide that we issued in the summer, and we're updating that to reflect the regulations and the further guidance from HHS. And that has a lot of this information outlined in it, and you should look for that on our both of our websites, hopefully by the end of the month. And with that, I think I will turn it over to Eduardo for Q&A.
Thank you. At this time, we are going to open up the floor for Q&A. I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypad. We'll pause for just a minute now to compile the roster. Thank you. Our first question comes from Cheryl Holman. Please go ahead.
My question is in the section when Sharon was talking about creating effective TJ programs and the non-paid activities, the option of possibly paying them. Question is, do they all have to be paid at the same rate? We are thinking minimum wage, but wondering if all of the activities need to be paid at minimum wage, or can we do more of a stipend-type concept, and would that still be countable?
This is Sharon. I think you can't do a stipend. I think it has to be an hourly wage, and I think it probably has to be minimum wage. There are some cases, I'm not an employment lawyer, there are some cases where certain kinds of employment are not subject to the minimum wage, but certainly most are. And I think for those activities to be considered paid, they would need an hourly wage attached to them.
And that would be the minimum wage.
And that would generally be the minimum wage. I guess one thing that we could check into is there's some very narrow exceptions to the minimum wage statute, and we should probably double check those before I make a definitive answer that it would have to be minimum wage.
We can get back to you, Cheryl.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sandra Mulligan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question has to do with a program that we pay after performance. What we do is take the amount of our TANF grant, divide it by our state minimum wage, and determine the number of hours that a client needs to work for the work and training program. So it's a pay after performance. Would this be defined as paid work?
I think generally not. I mean, what you're describing is more akin to a work experience position where their grant is divided by the minimum wage. Those are the number of hours that they're assigned, and then you only provide that benefit if they actually participate in the hours, although and I don't know your program well enough to know, usually even in some pay after performance structures, there's still good cause and reasons why people miss, and so they don't lose benefits if they miss because they're sick, for example. In subsidized employment, they are paid a wage, and while it may sound like a small distinction, and indeed from a cost perspective, it may be a small distinction, which might mean that you would want to change it to a wage-paying program, but when you pay a wage, things like payroll taxes apply, and people get I never remember W-2s, W-9. I'm very bad at remembering those forms. But, for example, they get tax statements that allow them to qualify for the EITC, for example. So I don't think a work experience program where you determine the number of hours by dividing the benefit by the minimum wage and then a pay-for-performance structure, but that isn't really a wage where worker protections and things like payroll taxes are taken out, I think that doesn't make it a wage. But I would say to you that if you're already running a program like that, it wouldn't add very much cost to turn it into a wage-paying program, and it has some real benefits, both, I think, programmatically in the message that recipients get, and I think that the benefit to families of being able to access the EITC in the nearer term and over the longer term, getting quarters of coverage for Social Security, are real benefits to families. And again, if you're already sort of paying at that wage rate, we're talking about not a lot of incremental cost to change it into a wage.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Lauerbach at CLASS. One thing I will add, though, is if part of the issue is what your state benefit levels are and that you get to not as many hours by dividing the grant by the minimum wage, there is a provision in the regs that lets you count however many hours the person is participating for that 20 hours. So then if you're doing educational activities that can count as job skills training with the remaining time, that might be a combination that would work.
Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to pose a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypads. Our next question comes from Andy Lindblom. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'm part of a network of programs, Service and Conservation Corps, and I think it's pretty safe to say that we actually would make excellent transitional job programs. We're job training for at-risk and high-risk young adults, and many of the participants in our program are TANF recipients or their families get TANF support. So my question becomes a little bit more procedural, and that is, how do we as a nonprofit access the system and basically say to the state, hi, we're here, and we would like to be one of your partners as you're looking for transitional job placements for the people who are receiving these benefits. How do we do that? How do we make that connection?
Abby, do you want to take that or do you want me to answer it?
I can. I think, you know, Andy, I think we should talk offline a little bit because I think there's a lot of work that Service Corps and TJ programs share. I think to answer your question, I think a lot of states put out RFPs for contracts for TANF programs, and you should certainly look for that and respond. Otherwise, just making yourself known and available and, you know, marketing yourselves, I guess, to key people in the state who are creating the transitional jobs programs.
Okay.
I would just add to that not to forget local as well as state.
Yes.
That depending on how the state runs its programs, those RFPs could be coming out from the county and not from the state. And the second thing I would say is that states and counties may not have, probably haven't thought of using you as a work site in their welfare to work program. And so I think there's an ability to be proactive and to find out who is in charge of, they may not have anybody in charge of transitional jobs if it's a state that doesn't have a transitional jobs program, but find out who within a county or a state are in charge of TANF policy, welfare to work programs, and really talk about what your program has to offer and what you might be able to do, and they can tell you what their requirements are, and it might build a relationship that, you know, never would happen just by responding to RFPs.
Right.
Okay.
Great. I think, Eduardo, I think we're going to move on to Diane, but I want, for people who still have questions in the queue, what I want to point out is that we are very happy to answer questions from you all at any time. And if your question was not answered, feel free to email me at afrank, F-R-A-N-K, at clasp.org, and I will be sure to get your question to whoever it is the best respondent and get back to you. So with that, I would want to turn the floor over now to Diane Klontz, who's going to tell us a lot about the exciting things that are going on in Washington State.
Great. Thanks, Abby. Again, this is Diane Klontz, and we represent the Washington State Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development. and we've been a WorkFirst partner agency since WorkFirst was created in 1997. I should mention that our WorkFirst program is Washington State's version of welfare reform. We have successfully used strong linkages with local communities to implement continuous improvements to the Community Jobs Program, which we call, as Abby mentioned, the Transitional Jobs Program, which we call Community Jobs. Our partnerships involve the Office of Financial Management, Department of Community Trade and Economic Development, Department of Social and Health Services, Employment Security Department, the State Board for Community and Technical Colleges, and the Department of Early Learning. Excuse me. Credit for our successful outcomes can be shared with our partnership, our community-based organizations, our employers, and, of course, our TANF participants. Without that combined effort, our partnership could not have successfully completed a rate of 64% of folks obtaining unsubsidized employment. We administer the Community Jobs Program and contract statewide with 16 community-based organizations to provide local service delivery. This includes establishing work sites and providing intensive case management, personal goal development, and support services. Parents in the program are in the activities for an average of 5 months and can participate up to 9 months. We currently serve about 2,200 WorkFirst parents each year using TANF dollars. Community Jobs is designed to serve hard-to-employ TANF parents, and since 1998, we have served every county in Washington State, and all the parents have had access to the Community Jobs program and have gained valuable work experience, marketable employment skills, confidence, and an avenue to permanent unsubsidized employment. Our typical CJ or Community Jobs parent has been unsuccessful in other WorkFirst programs and may need work experience combined with intensive case management services to manage their barriers to work. Our parents improve the quality of their community through working at nonprofit, community government, and tribal organizations. Local, private, nonprofit, and for-profit contractors provide parents with 20 hours of work a week, a paycheck, training, one-on-one support, and mentoring to resolve employment barriers. Community Jobs increases the TANF parent self-awareness, addresses barriers, and provides a work-life balance, and provides new avenues for unsubsidized employment. The Deficit Reduction Act has brought many challenges to Washington State, and our goal is to better serve our TANF parents and to ensure that they're put in the most appropriate program at the most appropriate time. We have worked to develop three new programs that will assist the parents in earning their grant and food stamps and aid them to either transition to a community jobs program or job search or lead them to unsubsidized employment. We have been given a modest amount of operating funds to implement these three new work programs, which we are calling Community Service, Community Works, and Community Work Experience. Our hope is to accomplish two goals: to provide new employment opportunities to TANF parents that have historically not been ready for community jobs or other WorkFirst services, and we want to help them have the ability to assist the state's ability to meet the increased participation rates under the new TANF guidelines. What I'd like to do now is introduce my colleague Eva Greenwald, who is going to give you some more information about our Community Jobs program, our new services, and how participation will be counted.
Thanks, Diane. We've designed three new programs to help TANF parents to enter the workplace and provide them additional opportunities to earn their TANF grant and food assistance. Work assignment hours for all three programs are individualized and based on the maximum number of hours each parent can work per the Federal Labor Standards Act. We've modeled the work assignment aspect of these three new programs after our successful CJ model. First of our new programs is called Community Service, and this will be an option for parents with current employment or core activities of less than 30 hours per week. The work assignment hours combined with the unsubsidized employment must total at least 20 hours per week if there are additional stacked activities, or it can be 30 hours per week if there are no stacked activities. This option is also available for parents who are pending starting another core activity within 4 weeks or during breaks from activities such as education. Second program we're calling Community Works will be an option for parents who are able to participate in a work activity with the additional support of a WorkFirst social worker or WorkFirst program specialist providing intensive family services. The third program, being Community Work Experience, will be an option to serve parents who are able to participate in a work activity, need up to 6 months of current work experience to acquire job skills in order to be competitive in the labor market, and who will need minimal case management to be successful on the worksite. Community Jobs and Career Jumps programs will remain the same programmatically. However, we will be expanding services. Our current operational budget is at approximately $12 million and was recently increased by approximately $3 million for the remainder of fiscal year 2007. For fiscal year 2008, beginning July 1st, we are projecting to nearly double our budget and services to our TANF parents. Community Jobs will continue to operate as a full-time program, which is a 32 to 40 hour per week program, and participation will be counted according to the DRA guidelines. Our contractors and TANF parents will report actual hours of participation on timesheets and activity logs, and those will document hours of daily participation. Reportable hours include actual hours spent at the worksite or in a non-core activity such as basic education, job skills training, and GED services. Our new TANF employment programs will be implemented in March with some of the automation following. We will have the required number of hours of participation based on the Federal Labor Standards Act already determined by the Department of Social and Health Services, and we will coordinate with all WorkFirst partners, including ourselves, the Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development, the Department of Social and Health Services, and the State Board for Community and Technical Colleges. We use our electronic data tracking system to manage all of the core and non-core activities. Our statewide electronic tracking system is going to assist us to ensure parents are participating full-time and that the federal requirements are met. Washington State is projecting to roll out new services for all agencies between March and May of this year, and will have the automation supporting the federal requirements by the required date of October 2007. We've been very proactive in working with the governor's WorkFirst subcabinet and the subcabinet to policymaking administrators to keep them informed of our efforts to meet the new regulations. We're looking forward to serving an increased number of parents and assist them as they transition into unsubsidized employment.
Great. Thanks, Diane and Eva. At this point, I also want to open up the lines for a Q&A period. So, Eduardo.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypad. We'll pause for just a minute now to compile the roster. Thank you. Our first question comes from Cheryl Holman. Please go ahead.
My question is about the TANF grant for the families in the TJ program. Are they still paid their old TANF grant in addition to the dollars that they would earn under the TJ program?
This is Eva. In our Washington State program, we pay them our state minimum wage, and then their grant is reduced based on that income. So they do, in some cases, still receive a residual grant.
Oh, very good. Their budget.
It is reduced.
Okay, in Chicago we call that budgeting. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Vanessa Lee. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have a question regarding your program design. The first question is, what is the case manager to participant ratio? And then also, can you further define intensive family services for one of the programs you mentioned?
Yes, this is Diane. And our caseload ratio ranges anywhere from 1 to 20 to 1 to probably 45. Just depends on the geographic area across the state, with some of them being real urban and some of them being real rural. And then to answer your second question about intensive family services, that could look very differently across the state. We pretty much leave the flexibility up to the contractors. That could be anywhere from a family dynamics class. It could be anywhere from, what else? The family dynamics, some classes are, let me see here, intensive family services. Some of those are provided directly through our Department of Social and Health Services, so we can connect with them for those services.
ma'am. Did that complete your question?
Yes, and one other question. The last question is, with regard to DRA, I'm a little confused, and you'll probably be able to answer it. If you have a JSJR component, do you pay them to go through, whether it's a one-week, two-week, four-week program, that JSJR program, do you pay them for that or not? And how does that sort of work in, you know, in light of the DRA regs?
When you're talking about, are you talking JS, is that referring to job search?
Yeah, the job search preparation, soft skills, interviewing, things of that nature. If you review that information with them, do you pay them for that? Most programs have either a two-week program or a four-week program. Do you have something similar to that as a part of your program?
In our community jobs program, we've structured it and broken it up into a 20 hours of actual work site that we pay wages for. We don't pay wages for any other activities, including training, education, or job search. The other 10 hours in the new design of our program will be for non-core accountable activities such as job skills training and education, GED, whatever that education component is. Then the additional 10 hours that gets us to 30 to 40 hours of total participation will be for barrier management and job search activities, and they are not paid for those.
So it's sort of combined. That 40-hour week includes work site and then additional non-core and other barrier management. Sort of it's combined all together, sort of not a separate stages in that sense.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I will. This is Abby Frank again. That's typical of traditional jobs programs is that the services go alongside the work, the actual work.
Thank you. Once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then the number one on your keypads. Thank you. Our next question comes from Carla Deltos. Please go ahead.
Yes, we're calling or listening from Louisiana, and we're interested to see how the TJ programs would adapt to the reentry programs for the incarcerated.
Sure, this is Andy. Transitional jobs programs are increasingly being used for people coming out of prison and are in jails, and we have a lot of information on that available at the National Transitional Jobs website, which is www.transitionaljobs.net. There's there is a very large research demonstration going on funded by the Joyce Foundation right now looking particularly at transitional jobs for this population. And if you're interested, we can get you more information about that. But these programs have been adapted for that population, are showing successful signs.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypad. Thank you. Our next question comes from Vanessa Lee. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. I guess one question is, when you were starting or when you started your programs, what would you say was one of the greatest barriers to your success, and how were you able to overcome that barrier to make your program as successful as it is?
And are you referring to the Transitional Jobs Program?
Right, the Washington State Community Jobs Program.
I think that one of our biggest challenges was just getting out in the community, bringing the locals together, and finding out what services were needed and how they were going to be administered. One thing that's very fortunate here in Washington State is our partnership with several of our state agencies, and that we do have an electronic tracking system that we all have access to, which each parent so we have access to all the or majority of the information about each one of the parents.
That's excellent.
Great.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sandra Mulligan. Please go ahead.
Thank you again. My question in regards to the three new programs, the community service, community work experience, and the other one, what kind of percentage where they're being paid for the 20 hours of hourly paid employment, what percentages with nonprofits, and what percentage of those jobs are with profit companies or retail establishments, companies, that sort of thing?
This is Eva. All three of our new programs are all with nonprofit organizations, are the work sites that will be used for those. So none of those are in for-profit private businesses.
So then the opportunity for the people in those positions to be hired at those nonprofits is probably not there, or do they sometimes hire those people?
There is a high percentage that do hire people once they've started a worksite there. It's not a requirement of any of our worksites that there's an expectation for them to hire parents at the end. Our main goal is to get the parents' current work experience so that they have transferable skills, a current reference, and work that they can put on an updated resume.
And this is Abby. Again, many transitional jobs programs do not have that expectation that the participant will be hired for unsubsidized employment at their workplace, but many do have job placement services at the conclusion of the program or at the conclusion of the work part of the program. So many programs build that in as a component upon completion.
And one other thing to add to that, with Washington State's model, we start job search activities from pretty much the first time that they walk in the door. So even while they're at the work site, job search activities are taking place.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypads. Thank you. Our next question comes from Deborah Shinofsky. Please go ahead.
Hi. I am with a nonprofit in Columbus, Ohio, and I know that we're going to have an RFP open in Columbus probably late January, early February, for work participation projects. I'm wondering, when I hear you say that, you know, how much can you afford to pay or this paid work experience, if we were the nonprofit applying to be a provider, how do you get the money for the payment? So would we then go out and make agreements with private sector and nonprofit employers who could use these people in a work experience, and then do they pay them directly? Do we charge them a rate, and then they pay us, and we show these customers on our payroll as the nonprofit? I'm just not really sure how this payment thing works. Can you clarify that for me?
This is Eva. How we work our community jobs program in Washington State is our contractors are the actual employer of record. All payroll is funneled through their agency. All of those wages are reimbursable expenses that we actually cover. So the state is billed for those wages.
I'm not sure if I'm still on. So are you saying that if I answer an RFP in Columbus, Ohio, that you think that I could actually bill the TANF provider, our job and family services, for the wages that we would pay people to be out on these work experiences at minimum wage at $5.15?
I'm saying that's how we do it in Washington State. How your state would do it would be dependent on how the RFP is written.
Well, that would be lovely. That answered a lot for me.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tanya Johnson Hill. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question is, does this program apply for part-time work also?
Our program is based on the number of hours that a parent can work, which is based on the Fair Labor Standards Act of their food stamps plus their grant, determines the number of hours per week that they can work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your keypads.
Can I just jump in for a second on the last question, Abby?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's important to distinguish two different kinds of programs and how you would set the number of hours of paid employment. States that are running work experience programs, one choice is to look at food stamps plus TANF divided by the minimum wage, and that's the number of hours that someone can participate. That's actually the formula that the reg set forth for work experience programs, which are typically not wage paying. That's not necessarily how Washington State's doing it, but I'm saying more generally, that's generally how work experience programs are done, where people participate in exchange for their TANF grant, not in exchange for wages. With subsidized employment programs, there's a choice for both the provider and for the state or the county that's interested in having a TJ program for TANF recipients of how many hours of paid activities, whether it's paid job site or paid other activities that they want to count as subsidized employment, that they want to provide. Typically, I think many states might want to do something close to 20 hours of paid employment because that's the number of hours that recipients need to participate in what's called core activities. There's two sets of work activities that count towards the participation requirements, core activities and non-core activities, and all recipients need to participate at least 20 hours in core activities, and some two-parent families need to participate for more than 20 in core activities. But if someone is getting a wage, for example, they might have 20 hours of paid participation in a TJ program. That, I'm not going to be fast enough to do that in my head, but let's just say that that works out to $550 a month in earnings. Then states can take those earnings and decide how they're going to budget them against the TANF grant. So if a state has a generous earnings disregard, then the family might be eligible for a residual TANF grant. That would mean that they were a TANF recipient and they were also employed and earning wages. And so the question of how many hours of paid employment depends a lot on sort of the resources that are available that a state or county is willing to commit to the program and the state's work participation rate goals. But I think generally at least 20 hours of paid participation to fill out that core hourly requirement is what many programs will have as a minimum.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Brendan Leung. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to know with Washington, with CJA, are you actually framing it as a grant diversion so that you need to get the client's consent to do the conversion, or is it being framed another way?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Consent to participate in the program?
No, to actually convert the grant into a wage.
When the person comes onto the TANF system, the
mm-hmm.
program is clearly defined and explained to them, and they sign an agreement that they will participate and understand how that grant will be converted and that they will be getting a paycheck at minimum wage for the hours worked.
I see. Mm-hmm. So it's actually being financed as if it's a grant diversion. Actually, part of the grant is actually converted into wage.
A portion of the grant is.
I have another question in terms of, in California, the state actually has put a lot of money into the community college system so that they build up the work experience component. I mean, are there any efforts to link with the community college and then having the work experience, pay work experience being used as almost like a TJ to satisfy the 20 hours of core?
We do work very closely with the community college, and some of our parents in the community jobs program may be placed at the college as a work site,
mm-hmm.
as well as any other nonprofit or state agencies.
So, but they are not using the college portion of the work experience money. They are still using the TANF dollars.
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Thanks. Edward, are there any other questions? Or
we do have
one more
question from Laura Carlton. Please go ahead.
Yes. I work with the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship, where they have apprenticeship training programs. Are you all familiar with that, and would that be an avenue that you all would connect with in regards to employment for the individuals or the participants? Would you all connect with that group of people?
You know, that's not something that we do currently. In the past, we have tried to look at some linkages. However, the opportunity just didn't show itself to work. So we are not currently working with our apprenticeship division.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Diane and Ava. I really appreciate your taking the time to answer these questions. I want to thank both Sharon and Diane for being on the call this afternoon. I think they have both shared a wealth of information that I hope is going to be helpful to you all as you go down this avenue further and think about how to create programs that will impact and affect families positively in the long term. What I want to point out to all of you is that we do have a paper available on the CLASS website and on the Transitional Jobs website. And the CLASS website is www.class.org that outlines a lot of this information, and it's called Increasing Opportunities, Creating and Expanding Transitional Jobs Programs for TANF Recipients under the Deficit Reduction Act. And this paper was just updated this week to reflect the further guidance and regulations that HHS provided this past December. And finally, I want to just let you all know a little bit about the National Transitional Jobs Network. We are a very large member organization, and we are, of which I am the co-chair. It is housed at the Heartland Alliance in Chicago, and they serve as the fiscal agent to the network. And we have a tremendous amount of resources available to you all, particularly to programs who are looking at expanding or needing more just real hands-on, in-depth technical assistance. We have people available and resources available that can help you start your program. So please don't hesitate to contact us. And the best way to look through what we have available and to get in touch with us is to go through our website at www.transitionaljobs.net. So, and again, I want to emphasize, if you have questions that were not answered again on the call today, please email me at afrank@class.org, and I will make sure that your questions are forwarded to the appropriate person. So with that, I just want to wrap up and thank you all for participating, and thank you to our speakers today for participating.
Thank you. This does conclude today's CLASS National Transitional Jobs Network call on transitional jobs programs for hard-to-serve TANF recipients. You may now disconnect your lines and have a wonderful day.